It was a little unclear, as you remember, if you were at the first breakfast, what it was going to be, to put it mildly. And the general topic is the one which I've drawn from the book I mentioned last time, Meniere's Patriotism in the Bible. And what I've been trying to talk about yesterday and then today are specific case studies, if you like, of the tensions and the difficulties when, on the one hand, we want to remain loyal and patriotic, if you like, in the best sense, to our nation, and at the same time be loyal to the demands that the Bible places on us. And certainly this is true in civil religion. I think we saw, they had a very interesting, I thought, discussion yesterday on the flag. We can see that there are differences, and that rather major differences, and not only generational differences. And I think also the issue of amnesty raises all kinds of difficult questions, because there are the demands of citizenship and obedience to the law on the one hand, and yet there are always also the moral issues involved in the other. And just by way of prelude, I want to just make two little points and then get into the specific issues. I would hope that we talk primarily about amnesty itself and not, let's say, about pacifism. Because pacifism is a whole different kind of topic, which would be fun and interesting and useful to talk about. But pacifism isn't really, the issue. Pacifism is, in a broader sense, feeds directly into amnesty. But if we could limit it to amnesty itself, and I think that would help give a direction and definition to this. And furthermore, I think it's important that we think about it, because one of the differences between the two political parties that is emerging is the plank over amnesty. Rather clearly, because Jimmy Carter has proposed, and it went through the Democratic Platform Committee last week, it was approved, they went for sort of a compromise. But Carter has one thing in which he calls it a pardon, and which is not amnesty, because the word amnesty simply means forgetfulness. What amnesty means in the sense that the people who are in Canada or Sweden or whoever now want it is total forgiveness, 100% forgiveness, that the slate is wiped clean again, that there's total forgetfulness, and that's the end of it. What Carter is saying is that there will be no restrictions, or what he's proposing is that there'll be no restrictions, no year of alternate service, anything else, like that, no signing of any sort of loyalty oath or anything, but that the government is pardoning the people for breaking the law, for either evading the draft or going to Canada or deserting from military participation. That's the difference. So that he's saying that there is forgiveness and that there will be no restrictions afterwards, but that there is something to be pardoned, that the wrongdoings were made. I mean, wrongs were committed. All right. And President Ford, as some of you know, has his program, and I'm not quite sure, because I don't think Governor Reagan has talked about it, that his is quite is visible, but President Ford's program is the one that went into effect in 1974, in which those who wanted to come back from Canada, from underground in the United States, from Sweden, wherever, would be asked to serve a certain amount of time in something like the old programs that we had for conscientious objectors, or the old CCC. I'm old enough to remember what the old Civilian Conservation Corps was in this country, where you only went out and worked for a year in forest rehabilitation, or whatever the case might be, or worked in a hospital as an aide, or something like that. So there are these kinds of differences, and it is an important issue, and it's an issue which is coming up again in 1976, because we do have, we think, about 10,000 men either underground in this country or in Canada or in Sweden, and that's a rather substantial number, 10,000, and there are historical precedents for amnesty and for pardons after a war. Lincoln, or it was not Lincoln, he died, Johnson issued pardons, McKinley, after the war. There were pardons in the 1920s for those who were objectors in World War I. And so the issue is with us right now. And what I would like to do is use Meniere's biblical text for the basis for our discussion. And I want to use a familiar story from the New Testament. It has to do with pardon and forgiveness and with the reactions to it, and then use that as the basis for a discussion, because it would be interesting, I think, and I'm sure right now we could plunge right into amnesty and we'd have a good discussion, but I think we should get some sort of biblical perspective on this. And the story is comes from Luke 7:30, and this won't take long to read, but I think it's important to read Luke 7:36 to the end of the chapter. One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house. and sat at the table. And behold, a woman of the city, who was a sinner, when she learned that he was sitting at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw it, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of a woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answering said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he answered, what is it, teacher? A certain creditor had two debtors, one who owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he forgave them both. Now which of them love him more? Simon answered, the one, I suppose, to whom he forgave more. And he said to him, you have judged rightly. Then in turning to the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house, you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. For she has loved much, but he has forgiven little. But he who is forgiven little loves little. And he said to her, your sins are forgiven. Then those who were at the table with him began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sins? And he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. I'd like to read briefly the commentary which Paul Meunier, who's a New Testament scholar, retired now, from Yale, makes about this, because I think it's a little long, but it helps focus our attention on this Bible text as a source for discussion and consideration of amnesty as an issue. Luke's story presents one version of an eternal triangle, two men and a woman. In this drama, three actors appear, and the fourth stands invisible in the wing. Each of the visible players, Simon, the woman, Jesus, embodies a dominant force. The story sets up a collision among those forces. In the wings, as prompter and director, is the hidden God, the judge of sin and the source of forgiveness. The woman expressed the impulse of penitence, for she acknowledged herself as a sinner and recognized in Jesus an offer of God's grace. Her weeping proved her penitence, for her care for Jesus proved how penitence is transformed into gratitude by forgiveness. Forgiven much, she loved much. In her, penitence plus gratitude equaled peace. A different force moved Simon. He was honest enough to call a spade a spade. He was outraged by Jesus' indifference to the woman's record. He felt he had no recourse but to condemn the woman and to attack Jesus. Yet Simon was the villain of the story. So powerful was his devotion to righteousness and honesty that no room was left in him for penitence or gratitude. Jesus became the conduit for forgiveness in its weakness and in its power. He saw in the hearts of the other two, he saw into the hearts of the other two, engaged their sin and their love. He had been authorized by the hidden actor to cancel debts, whether small or large. On this occasion, God's forgiveness proved stronger than the woman's sin. She welcomed it, but weaker than Simon's, unable to overcome his resistance. Thus, the story illustrates the relative power of these three forces: penitence, self-righteousness, forgiveness. Yet we may venture to criticize the story on at least two grounds. In the first place, the identification of the actors prejudices the Christian reader. Simon is presented as a Pharisee, the kiss of death, for every reader knows that Pharisees are by definition villains and hypocrites. So too, the reader will prejudge the woman sentimentally as a Christian in disguise. The same reader knows in advance that Jesus can say and do nothing wrong. The story is told to stifle dissent over Jesus' action. In the second place, the story denies to the Pharisee the courtesy of, quote, equal time. He had no opportunity for rebuttal. Given the benefit of a free press, he could surely have mounted an impressive answer. As a sample, and here is Meunier's sort of using a stream of consciousness to technique to show what must have gone on or what could well have gone on in Simon's mind as this incident unfolded. That crazy allegory put me in a trap, Lord. It does recognize the basic fact that the woman owes God a greater debt than I do, but it makes that fact the basis for nonsense. What creditor would be stupid enough to cancel a debt of 1,000 diners as readily as one of 100? For God to do that would destroy his own law and defy justice. It would invite everyone to break the greatest commandments. It would deny justice to those who obey these commandments, as well as to those who have been punished for their sins. This woman has defied the Ten Commandments. To ease her conscience by declaring her forgiven would make those commandments null and void. It would destroy respect for all law and faith in all justice. You have been influenced by the sentimental show of affection, and you have no firm evidence that God is as easy on sinners as you are. Who are you to distort God's justice in this way? That's the end of the stream of consciousness. Readers are invited, well, no, that's just a technique at that point. But you see the nice contrast that's set up in this particular story as to at what point should wrongdoing be forgiven? At what point should clear recognition of established rules and laws be forgiven in the name in the name really of compassion and forgiveness? So with that in mind, and with one belt of coffee, I think, because it's, as you can tell from the voice, I talked too much last night.
Besetting sin.
I guess. I'm too old to change. All right. Now, let me start off with a specific question here on this. If we are interested in some kind of amnesty or pardon, first of all, are we saying that to pardon or to forgive those who acted out of religious and moral convictions, are we saying then that the United States was wrong in getting into the war in the first place? Is that what we're saying? Because that's the way some people interpret it. Let me read you just as we like to call it a discussion opener. Fred E. Darling, an official of the Non-Commissioned Officers Association, had a different morality. To grant even conditional amnesty to these men is to, quote, let them return to the country they have shunned. It would be, he said, a slap in the face to the millions of men who were drafted, who were wounded, who were maimed, or who were killed in a bloody, unpopular war. The good God calls upon us to be merciful, to forgive our trespassers, but he did not mention amnesty. So what are we saying about, are we saying that the war was wrong by saying that those who refused to go into it should be allowed back into society fully and completely? Is it, you know, what I'm trying to say is an ex post facto here. Are we saying now that the war is over that we're so embarrassed by it because it turned out so badly that therefore we're trying to ease our consciences about the error of going into the war by pardoning those who saw in 1965 and 66 that it was wrong, where many of the rest of us didn't see it until, you know, later.
How was it back in Lincoln's time, or Johnson's time, or McKinley's time? What was the sentiment nationally for granting of amnesty then?
Well, McKinley's was, the two were really different because one was a domestic thing and one was a foreign war. And there were rather strict provisions established so far as the conditions for amnesty were concerned. And this is one distinction that Carter makes too, that he wouldn't issue amnesty or pardon for deserters once you were in the military. That would be, deserters would be handled on a case-by-case basis, because and the same was true at that point, because if you join the military, you are saying at that point that you accept the discipline of the military. And that you can't, you know, keep joining things and then disagreeing with it later on, because, you know, you go through life and, you know, you suddenly back out all the time, and you have to make, once you make a commitment, you should be able to, you know, follow through on a commitment and obey, you know, you take the oath obey the Constitution. And so therefore, deserters were treated rather badly, but put in jail and so on. But basically, others, the conscientious objectors were, well, how do I put it this way? Time became the great healer, and they moved slowly, and it wasn't given a good deal of publicity. But time was allowed to set in, so that it didn't look as though they were rushing right in after the war to pretend that the war never happened or that these people hadn't really done anything wrong. I would say let it go with that. But this is a different kind of war, because there was so little public support for it after a while. And what I'm wondering, on the basis of the text that we talk about here, that are we being too sentimental? Because as this officer said, we can come around and talk about love and compassion and everything else, and that simply ignores the fact that in order to have a society, you have to be able to enforce the laws in society, and that if you open the doors to forgiveness here and for dropping the restrictions on obedience to law, what's to stop it from multiplying, you know, into other areas? For instance, what if a person refused to pay taxes on the basis of that he disagreed with the fact that the money is going primarily to the military, and that therefore felt that he shouldn't have to pay taxes because he didn't want his money to go to the military. I just soon cut back on my 1040 contributions. Like most of you, I worked until I think it's April 1st every year for the government. I just assume, you know, move that back a little bit till about February. But I don't. Yes?
Just on a personal level, I have very, very mixed feelings about this amnesty. My oldest son was in the service and was with helicopters and was in Vietnam for a year and a half. And just about the time he got back, my second son was just having to sign up for the draft. And his brother said, you know, don't go. Just get away. Just don't go. Because he had seen so much and been through, you know, all these. It was just very hard on him emotionally. And his younger brother was even more sensitive. And he thought, you know, this would, you know, it could very possibly destroy him. And so, you know, I felt like even though my oldest son went, if my second son would have gone to Canada, would have gone anywhere, I would have forgiven him for sure, so I don't know about other people's sons who did go. I mean, I think it's a very difficult kind of a judgment to make. It would be for me to say, you know, listen, this is actually wrong. The war, I don't think any war is good, but then maybe that's because I'm a mother.
Okay, yeah, I was just going to say that's the point. I mean, can a mother's concern override the need for, which is a very real thing, override the need for an equal enforcement of the law for all people?
I don't know. I know there was a woman not too long ago who was refusing to pay her taxes because she didn't believe in the military. And that was in the newspapers, and I don't remember how it was resolved.
Yeah. Well, what happens is that the government goes, they're also used to this, they go down and garnish your, you know, your salary, and they do it, they take it at the other end. And so it comes, so they're there, but then they allow that to go on. They don't go to jail or something refusing to pay their taxes. But you were objecting because of what your older son had told you about the war.
Mm-hmm. And on a personal level, you know, I don't know that wars have ever solved anything, and yet I can't say that, you know, it's never good to have a war, because there always have been wars, and I guess it's predicted that there always will be wars. And yet, I really can't feel that wars have ever solved anything.
Your younger son would have been under the category of conscientious objector, or simply objector to this particular war?
It's hard to say, because, you know, he just registered for the draft, and then it was over, we weren't drafting. He did register, but if it came down to him going, he very well might have been conscientious objector, or he might just have gone to Canada. I really don't know. Or he might have even gone into the service. You know, I can't say what they would have done. But either way, I would have let him make the decision. But I certainly, I would have to forgive him. And so then when it comes to other people's sons who have made the decision that they can't do it, I don't know. You know, I feel like amnesty is something that, you know, on one side I say, you know, they should have to go if the rest of the kids have to go. But yet, it's really, for me, it's an impossible question.
What kind of distinctions are made between, say, conscientious objector, somebody who didn't object but just ran away, and somebody who was in and deserted?
Yeah, they come in different categories. The CO is recognized as having the highest priority because he saw through the issues ahead of time and has been willing to take a stand and either accept alternate service or else go to jail as one of the two alternatives at that time. And that's who the amnesty program is directed at primarily, because there was a, you know, it's like the difference between first and second and third degree, you know, levels of crime because of premeditation ahead of time. And then the worst is those who have been in the military. I mean, the lowest category, so to speak, is a deserter. And also those who have simply left the country without even registering for the draft in the first place. And that's, they're pretty much in the same category.
And but the of these are we talking about?
Now let's talk about the COs.
Just let me ask this information. When Carter is talking about amnesty, which category?
He's talking about the conscientious objectors, the COs. He would say that the deserters should be handled on a case-to-case basis. where there can be just cause shown for it, fine, but where there's deliberate willful evasion because of danger or something, that's something else again. Yeah.
On a personal level, I can say everybody that I've met that fought in Vietnam is carrying some kind of scar because of it, and they're, you know, really kind of suffering since they were over there and come back. And I am just personally very happy that the guys took off and went to Canada or whatever, and instead of going over there and suffering. And I'm just really thankful and grateful that they took an alternative route instead of going over there.
Of course, those who come back from every war are scarred.
Mm-hmm.
Relatives of mine have been gassed in the First World War, and families torn up in the Second World War. I lost a brother in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what difference it makes whether it's one war or another. The scars are there.
Mm-hmm.
The wreckage, the human wreckage, is there.
Mm-hmm.
If it's going to be only on a personal level, you could take a vote and everybody would be in favor of amnesty, but that's not the question, is it?
Yeah.
What we personally want?
I guess we do really have to think about the security of our country. I guess that's partially involved in the responsibility toward that we all have. That's a harder question.
But we really didn't ask that question back when you first became involved. No one believed in the security of the country. Well, of course, I guess some people who live and die by the domino theory at the end would say that Vietnam was something worth getting into. But in the end, it did become so popular that wasn't even a question anymore. And now, in retrospect, people would say that was never a point. Police action, whether in Korea or Vietnam, anywhere, Cambodia.
The security of our own country was not the question.
Yeah.
Well, I don't understand something here. I thought conscientious objectors served, but not in the military. They served in hospitals in our country. I can think of a neighbor boy who went as an aide to a convict. I see no reason they would need amnesty. They have served in a different capacity.
My son had a friend who was a Jehovah's Witness, and I mean, he was a conscientious interest objector who would not serve the military in any way.
I see.
And he was threatened with loneliness.
And that's why there are two kinds of COs.
Well, there are some, but, Mark?
The only thing is, I mean, there are people who claim, it's a funny thing to say you are a CO. People say, I object conscientiously against the war, and call themselves a CO. And then there are those who are COs by the fact that they went to the mill and got their CO status.
Through the
thing. They went to the board, they hacked it all out, and they said, yes, okay, we'll give you the W-4 status, and then they will go from there. Some people, I mean, it's a kind of like a big group, but some are kind of legally so, and some are just declared themselves such.
I see. Well, I thought all COs served in some capacity. I didn't know that.
No.
Evelyn? And the legality of establishing them is very complicated. I have a friend in Minneapolis, you probably know whom I won't name right now either, but whose son that was trying to establish some kind of a CO status some years ago, and really, you know, was fighting through the courts, and I think finally did go to Canada because they wouldn't classify him as a CO.
Interesting that someone who got CO status in 1969 spent 2 years in Holden Village as alternate service.
Mm-hmm. I know, I own the person I'm thinking of here, right here in a convalescent hospital as the CO. This was his assignment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think something that we should consider in thinking about amnesty is how the policies were made in the first place, as Mark indicated. You know, how did we ever get into it in the first place, and what kind of general support was there for the war? And also, the idea that really, many of the young men who refused to go for one reason or another were really the conscience of the country, and really awakened, I think, all of us to the moral aspect of being here.
On the other hand, I wouldn't want my brother who gave his life there to be considered not a part of the conscience of the country. I mean, he went because he believed you know, that this was what his country asked him to do. And he's part of the conscience of the country, too.
But both sides have to be heard, and one can't be stamped out.
All we're hearing here, though, is the one side.
Okay.
I had two sons that was in the service. Neither one of them were over to across the water. Both one was in the big hospital up east, and the other one was in the military police. And so I was very fortunate there.
Yeah. You didn't have that decision really to make.
I just wanted to share what was finally brought out, that both the one who serves his country and the one who felt strongly about being a CO should have that freedom and that right. And I think they both serve themselves. If he chose, you know, someone chooses to go in the war and obey the draft as it was a law, that is his choice. He also had the choice, which is a much probably harder social pressure choice, to be a CO. And the consequences were greater. But I just feel that those are the two choices that they have as free people in this country, and that I don't think that granting amnesty takes away from the choice of the people who served. Maybe I'm wrong in that. Do you feel that if someone has served in the services, does that take away from what he did? Because amnesty is granted to someone who doesn't.
A lot of people feel that does, very strongly.
This is maybe not directly related to amnesty, but I think the point is this. Should we have universal service also in peacetime? Should there be some citizen obligation by both men and women, see, for a year of service or something, whatever, you know? And I think if we're talking about equality, why should just the young men be expected to serve? Why not the young women? Now, that's what women's movements really need to consider, and some of them forget it and some don't. You know, if there's some citizenship responsibility in service, why just young men and why just certain young men? Okay, why not go the route of some universal service for everybody, also in peacetime? I mean, now that's one of the alternatives, I think, which we've never really seriously considered, but some other countries do. And then in wartime, if we're unfortunate enough to be in a war, then, all right, everybody serves, men and women. But that's where you have some option of choice. Now, you see, of course, who wants to go get shot? Now, that gets difficult. But I think that's another aspect of it. Why should service to the country only be seen in terms of fighting in a war?
Do we want to...
Now maybe that's beside
yeah.
the issue from amnesty, but it's a background.
Do we want to create a society where it's required of everybody to have one, let's say, a year of service? Is that?
I think that's a viable option.
What type of service?
You know, working with
military
conservation, hospitals.
Digging ditches with the rains, warm, whatever needs to be done. That isn't being done by... I mean, it's an issue, you know, that needs to be considered sometime, but maybe not in relation to amnesty.
Because some people would say that they don't owe the government that if you allow that to happen, that the government can use that as a wedge and move from one to two, and pretty soon you've created a kind of a government which has far too much control over their lives. I don't know.
What I'm hung up in, why is it that the highest way of serving your country and the noblest way is to fight in war? But can't you really sacrifice your life? I mean, really give yourself in peacemaking activity, in which you might actually have to lay down your life occasionally, you know.
I'm not sure of my statistic, but it seemed like not too long ago I heard that there's something like 4 out of 5 people now who work for a government of some kind at either a local or a federal or a state level. And perhaps by taking her suggestion, we could eliminate some of the payroll and have a more of a feeling of civic responsibility that would spread, that wouldn't have to be connected, like you say, with the military. Yeah. That would be a very good idea, because with this amnesty question, I think we are getting maybe into a question of responsibility to our country as a community of people who are, you know, have something to consider, that we are living here in this country. And I think we're losing a lot of this loyalty somewhere, or maybe it's just a feeling that I get from the media.
Well, I think it's almost an opposite. Instead of being doing something for our country, it's almost the opposite. Well, what's the government going to hand me now? You know, it's becoming a trend, you know, the give me instead of the give for responsibility.
The government's certainly taking whole lots, though, great energy. And the question that arose, I think, a moment ago was, to whom do our lives belong?
Right.
And can the government treat us as if we are property at their disposal, to take a slice out of our lives as they choose, as if that is government right? And when one sees the encroachment of government into so many areas of our lives, then we need to ask, by what right can they treat me as if I'm their property?
That's a big...
In America, I think that's the real crux. Just that the people don't ask that question in many countries.
But perhaps, maybe by everyone taking this type of responsibility, people would get more involved in actually what is happening in government. Maybe if they, you know, had to spend some of their personal time really thinking about what's happening, not just going out and digging ditches, but if there was some way that we could educate people to be more aware of what is actually happening in our government, you know, like they're working 4 months out of the year to pay taxes for all these things that they're doing, and yet I think most of us don't really know what to do about it.
I see one real dilemma here is that if there isn't some sort of voluntary participation, then obviously, in the vacuum that's created, it'll be the professionals who take over. Those who are on the payroll, so to speak, or those who have a personal stake in it, which happens in political parties. And what's happening now, I don't want to get started on the 76 thing, but what's happening clearly is that the parties themselves don't provide the functions that they used to in fundraising and advertising and this sort of thing, because now we have public relations organizations who are doing all this sort of thing, and a lot of citizens are missing out on, you know, some very active involvement. You want to share with us your reaction to running for delegate? I thought that was interesting that Governor Brown comes on as sort of an anti-government figure, and yet his control over the party machinery in California was, you know, fairly secure.
In the particular congressional district in California that I ran for delegating, every candidate had a separate caucus on a Sunday afternoon. And there were about 600 people at Brown's caucus. The only people running for delegate, and there were 90 of those, only people who knew what the rules of the caucus were going to be, what the order in which the candidates for delegate were going to speak, whether there would be printed material available. The only people that knew that were a slate of seven people that were Brown's particular supporters within the congressional district. So they got into the room ahead of time and had all the materials there and prepared, and in fact served sandwiches to everybody after it was all over. It was very well organized. There was very little opportunity for anybody to come in off the street or just with an interest in it and getting there.
Well, they got 3 out of 10 that were free.
Maybe we're at the point where our lives and our society is so complex that the only way we can survive is to have specialists do it all, really, because it's much more difficult for us because our own lives are that complex, and there are so many different demands on family, church, and the other places, that to expect more of this sort of participation is almost it's unwieldy. Let me put it in a little different sense, because it ties in with the point you were trying to make. Is there any way, do you think, we can prevent government from becoming more and more powerful in our lives? With things like the draft would be a very good example. even in draft and peacetime, and even when the government has an unpopular war. That's I think, is much at the heart of it. Because what happens when the government, you know, makes a mistake? And how do you repay for all the suffering and all the rest that's gone into that particular mistake? In America, we have a different attitude towards this in Europe, because in Europe, I think people are much more fatalistic about governments making mistakes. I've often mentioned in class, and it's a good example, if you lived in Alsace-Lorraine, for instance, let's say in the 20th century, you wouldn't really be very surprised about the ongoing presence of war, because either the French were marching in and driving the Germans out, or the Germans were marching in and driving the French out, and you simply became fatalistic about this sort of thing. You accepted war as a part of way of life, and that you didn't have any high hopes or crusades that you were going to make the world safe for democracy or establish the four freedoms whatever, and therefore you're much more fatalistic. But in this, and you accept government, you expect inefficiency and corruption in the government. And it should be said about the draft thing that if in the 1860s and the 70s, if we look back carefully, I think we'd find that many of our ancestors, especially if they came from Scandinavia or from Germany, came over to this country to avoid the draft. And we don't condemn them as cowards or deserters or whatever. Time and again, you'll find that the draft in Germany was especially unpopular, and they came over. But the point I want to make is that in this country, we don't have this sort of fatalistic attitude, and we feel we have some sort of control over the government. We would like to think we have some voice in the government, and therefore, when the government comes up with a war which backfired the way this did, we don't quite know what to do, because we feel that we're entitled to more than this, whereas by contrast in European countries, they are much more fatalistic about this. And therefore, we resent the government having this kind of power and authority. Yet, nobody gets involved enough, or nobody really knows what to do in terms of stopping it or blowing the whistle. Somebody would mention some of the CEOs did act as a conscience, and I think in that sense brought the issue more vividly to the American public than if this hadn't been the case. But I don't know if we're not really caught here in a very difficult problem, because if we hold our ultimate allegiance to Jesus as Lord, how do we answer for the fact then that 25 to 30% of our income and so much of our time and even our lives, if necessary, go in a different direction?
Well, but we are in the world. I mean, how can we say that government doesn't have some great control over our lives? It does. I mean, and who is the government but ourselves? We are the ones who choose those, to represent us. And all this rock throwing at the government, really is we're punishing ourselves. And we did dispense with Richard Nixon in a most cruel way, and with all of his people. We cast them out of the temple.
Not the temple. Now, that's a terrible thing to say. That confusion this religiosity about the way one thinks about the government. Now, I agree entirely that in a democracy we get the government we deserve. So why bitch about it? If we in a democracy, who's to blame for the government but the people who put them there? But they then also in democratic theory are our servants.
Certainly.
And this whole mystique of leadership and sacredness of high office and the sacred pigskins and parchments and the documents that are invoked in all of that mystique allows these people to inflate themselves to a dimension which gets to be demonic, playing God rather than as the servants of the people. And the old ideal of citizen leaders, that the system has developed in such a way as to make that now virtually impossible.
Government people aren't the only ones who find themselves inflating their own selves. I mean, theologians are the same, and plumbers.
Yes, but you can't, if you let them get away with it, then you're to blame for
theologians
it.
Theologians like have an easier time getting away with it than government people.
But that's what we call a voluntary association, who don't have the power of life and death and dollars and cents over us. and they aren't necessarily responsible to us. If theologians want to have an inflated sense of themselves, you know, God bless them, let them. You know, I don't have to pay any attention to them because they can't, you know, do anything to me. But, you know, the public officials can.
Yeah, the theologians get tenure and politicians don't.
That's true. Yeah. But you can ignore politicians, you can ignore theologians because they don't take that, you know, when you get your paycheck, you see FICA on it, but you don't see, you know, a donation to theologians. I always wondered who this guy FICA was, you know, on my paycheck until I found out.
I think we're still so terribly idealistic about our government and about our country that we keep swinging from one extreme to the other. It's either all good or something's wrong and everything's wrong, and we become terribly negative about it, and it seems to me that that's part of why it's so difficult for us to grant amnesty to people, because it might mean that we were wrong. Well, so what? You know, we're all wrong individually all the time, or periodically, and as a country, we can't expect that we're always going to be right. So we were wrong. Okay, so what? Let's, you know, do the best thing under the circumstances.
Because one of the reasons that it's so difficult, and this is the one that Jack mentioned here, because many people would interpret this to mean that the lives which are sacrificed now simply becomes a meaningless sacrifice, and that's very hard for many people to acknowledge.
Yeah, there's a point of where was it wrong? You know, I mean, that's a big problem too. Was it wrong because we didn't win? You know, that's some way.
Yeah, that's the point, right? Because, excuse me.
I was going to say, and then what about the future? I keep thinking of that, and I don't know, we'll probably be blasted to somewhere. If there is another war, but if we're all this forgiveness, then what? Then the draft comes along, people say, well, I'm going to Canada, or I'm going somewhere, and what do we do then? I don't know.
I think that people that left the country, that was not an easy way out. And I think that too many people look at it and say, well, in the future, you know, all these people are going to see a war coming and they're just going to take off and expect this pardon afterwards. And I don't think that it's that easy of a decision. I think that the people that left the country or that, you know, dodged the draft, I don't think they did it just, you know, out of frivolity or whatever. I think that they had really deep convictions and, they weren't expecting a pardon. And I think that it was, you know, really a deep moral thing that made them leave. And I think when people look at it and they say, you know, well, thousands will just do that in the future if there's another war, you know, I think that it is a really a tough decision, and it's not an easy way out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and because this is the point of the text, too, that there had to be contrition before there was forgiveness. And that was the point that Minear makes, I think, and makes rather well, that there was honest contrition. And when that's the case, then obviously forgiveness is obviously the right Christian response to make in this particular case. The question then becomes, of course, a different one. How much punishment is enough? You know, how much is enough? At what point do you decide that, you know, that this is enough, a jail sentence or whatever it might be, is adequate? How do you determine that sort of thing?
And what are the political implications of in the future? If you grant amnesty now, does that suggest that you have to rewrite the rules, you know, for the next war that's coming up? People are going to say, well, it's going to cost me so much, let me pay my tax ahead of time and then not worry about it. I want my amnesty statement granted at the front end rather than having to go through all this trauma of waiting.
Are there any previous Supreme Court precedent-setting decisions that might hinge on this, or are they being asked the question, or is it anything that would be presented to them, their interpretation would be such a legalistic thing that it's the government can have a draft.
The Supreme Court won't touch it. They have the advantage which nobody else has in this country. If they don't want to do something, they don't have to. And they won't touch these cases because they simply argue this is beyond their kind of jurisdiction. Because you open up too many, you know, they would say you open up too many considerations. Yeah. But we don't really know why, you know, and that's the general interpretation, because many times they'll just refuse a case and they won't say why they're refusing it. So it stands on the lower level. And then we get into a jurisdictional problem here, because sometimes amnesty or some kind of pardon is granted in one judicial district but not in another. It depends on the judge at work. So the level of justice or the kind of justice you get depends on where you live in a country, which is kind of, you know, unfair.
But But we look at in the correctional process or in the correctional field which I'm involved in,
yeah.
we do even have pardons for murders or the most serious crimes that can be made.
Right.
And when you equate that with the dodging the draft and so on, it would seem to argue toward amnesty.
Yeah, but, you know, the real question here is why this in this one case should forgiveness be should be granted, whereas you wouldn't do it in other cases, like Joan Baez not paying her taxes. What's so special about amnesty? I mean, about COs or objections to wars? Should they be a special category?
Yeah, this strikes the very heart of the guilt and the condemnation, and especially too when another generation went through such an amazing period of time, which I really have to always remind myself. When it was 1942, even America, all of America, there was a confidence that they would win, but no one knew for sure. And everybody went. Everybody. It was a crusade.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are still, this is my father, this is my grandfather, this is people who have had, who I deal with. Now my son will deal in an entirely different way, because I wouldn't have had that opportunity. Well, I didn't go through that. I wasn't called upon.
You were lucky.
Until it happened, I think it's a tough thing. It's just going to have to work.
And amnesty is forgiveness for guilt. Okay. But if those who took the different way up don't see that as being wrong, you see, that's one of the, why so many refuse to accept amnesty conditions. They don't see it as guilt. You see, that gets the question, what is guilt in terms of the national sense?
And you get into
the individual had the right to make that decision, or does the government say this is guilt?
And you get into the higher law argument, which is a very, very thick terrain indeed.
Is it not presumptuous for a government to speak as of its forgiving?
That's what these guys are saying.
That's what the...
That would mean that I could confess my sins to the government, and the government would forgive me. Then what role is government playing then for me?
Well, it would be, they wouldn't care about your sins of lying or something, because that doesn't affect the public welfare, you're not breaking a public law, but it would be, in this one case, you were breaking, a public law, which should be enforced equally for all people. That's, in that sense, the government claims the right of, quote, forgiveness. I would imagine they aren't acting as a priest in this case, but they're simply saying as we would in pardons, and in a way a parole board is forgiving.
That's removing a penalty.
Is it? I'm sorry?
Removing a penalty.
Removing a penalty, right.
And pardon is a more modest word, or removing a penalty. And if Carter is the sort of man who talks about forgiveness, that's a relevant factor to the previous discussion about his religion.
Yes. I think it comes out of his concern for these. He sees these in moral terms rather than in practical terms or political terms.
What is the good of the welfare of the, how is the welfare of the nation served by either removing the penalty or not with regard to these 10,000?
It's a matter of balancing there, because on the one hand, if you have these men, it does no good to keep them undercover or in Canada or in Sweden any longer. That serves no useful purpose any longer so far as they're concerned. On the other hand, there are many people who feel very strongly that the only way in which their sacrifices made any sense at all was to see to it that those who broke the law in this sense were not, they have a different perspective, are not really in a sense being rewarded. Because you have two entirely different perceptions of the legality or the illegality of obeying the law. Because those who look at deserters as deserters say that they were breaking the law, and what they were doing was immoral, and those who felt that the laws were immoral felt that they were doing the moral thing, the highly moral thing, and that, as you said, it required more courage to go to Canada or to Sweden than it would do to and this is John Keane, you remember, the Vietnam vets fellow who was so powerful in the late, around 1969-70, he said that it took more courage to go underground than it did to, obey the laws.
Oh, geez, that's a bunch of bullshit. What more courage to go to Canada than to go to Vietnam?
Oh. Yeah. This is the dimension of the mystique that is being built up. And while one may recognize that there were profound moral considerations and promptings in some of those who went to Canada, there were also those who went to Canada to save their skin and avoid getting shot.
There's a difference between physical courage and moral courage.
I don't think it was all a moral question, though. I agree, you know, that with some, it probably definitely was a moral question, but I don't think that it was a moral question with all.
And you have these people in the service, too, you know.
Yeah, after they got in, after they realized, you know, then they were deserters. We had deserters, too. And like I say, they're put in a different category, and yet they tried, you know, maybe they really, you know, fought for their country's sake, they should, and yet when they got into it for their own feelings, whatever they might have been, they couldn't. And so where is the distinction as to the punishment? I don't understand, except that they have made the commitment, but that's another.
Yeah, and you have others who went in, who made the decision, or did not make the decision to go the CO route at first to see what their number would be, and if their number was pretty small, they may have made a decision at that point. Or if they went in then, they still had another point where they could make a decision. They might have been sitting at a hospital in Pasadena or somewhere like that, which seemed pretty good, so they could go along. And so all the way along, there were these decisions in getting to the front lines and then deciding. And even there, the decision is based on, you know, is it a mental, is it really an emotional problem that they had, and does that make a difference in whether you forgive or not, or there's so many options all the way along the line.
One easy, and the clearest way would be a blanket amnesty, because then you wouldn't have to make these gradations and these very difficult kinds of decisions. That, and this was the point really of the text, that there was a blanket forgiveness, total and complete forgiveness, that came at that point once contrition was evident. And that shocked people who had been, you know, like Simon, who had been obeying the law. And that really is the thrust, really. I think you can see it in Meniere's final, if I get my glasses on again, his final summation on this point, that the question here that I think maybe we'll just leave you with this one. And this one, those who fear amnesty all often fear the effects that it will have on social institutions. Like you mentioned, can we have another draft if we have amnesty, you know, or forgiveness this time? Who will ever obey it? Does this fear help us understand why Jesus' practice of unlimited forgiveness released such explosive hostility? I mean, the point in the text where Simon was very, very upset when there was, you know, unlimited forgiveness that took place because, you know, he disagreed with us. Should any secular government be expected to determine its policies by reference to God's way of governing mankind? There's one that could take up the rest of the day on this. But I think it's the right question to ask. Should any secular government be expected to determine its policies by reference to God's way of governing mankind? In other words, if military service is necessary for the survival of the nation, let's not get into whether or not Vietnam was necessary for the survival of the nation, because then you get into selective objection. You can say, I'm not going to fight in this war, but I might fight in another one, and that's another issue. But since the government exists for protection of property, and protection of lives, and obviously it has the right to make war to do this, or defend, if you want to call it defensive war, okay. And that, if that's the case, then shouldn't it be governed simply by the need for survival rather than some reference to some transcendent norm? I guess that's a complicated enough question to leave you with on this. Or, on the other hand, since it's a bicentennial, don't we pride ourselves on being, you know, a nation under God? We even put that into our Pledge of Allegiance. And once we open up that sort of consideration for the basis for our specific laws, then aren't we carried in a way in which we really have to respect this? And if that shows up in things like the amnesty issue, then shouldn't that be, you know, a crucial factor for us? Because there are many societies where obviously this simply wouldn't be the case. Okay, I guess it's 5-2. I don't know. If we can leave with a question, I'm happy. We're not like a laboratory course. I remember when in my classes, when I leave everybody up in the air, the pre-meds are really very upset because we haven't sort of answered the question. Because if you make a diagnosis, you have to have a prescription, and you have to write out something on a little pad and take some tetracycline or something, and that takes care of it. But we don't do that here. We don't have any medicine to take. We just have ambiguity.